Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday the 29th of June, these are our main stories. A French court has sentenced the country's former prime minister to jail for corruption in a case involving his wife. We'll hear the details. Pakistani authorities say four gunmen who attacked the stock exchange in Karachi have been killed, along with several others. Also,
if there's a few that are extreme, they will infect the others in the camp because people are weak.
And the militants of Islamic State are building support in Kurdish-controlled detention camps. Plus,
30% of intensive care patients who survive COVID-19 will suffer post-traumatic stress disorder and 15% depression.
Doctors treating people with coronavirus say some will need support with their mental health. And we've news about a very unusual property that's gone on sale in New Zealand. In France, it's been dubbed Penelope Gate. Just before we recorded this podcast, a French court found the former Prime Minister, François Fillon, guilty in a corruption case involving payment of public money to his wife, Penelope, for a fake job. Our reporter David Chazan is in Paris, and I asked him for details of the sentence.
Well, the court found them guilty of embezzling more than 1 million euros of public money. Now, this relates to money that was paid to Penelope Fillon over more than a decade for working as her husband's parliamentary aide. Now, during the trial, the Fillons insisted that she had done that job, but they were unable to convince the court that she had actually performed any of the duties such a job would demand. Now, Val, just within the last minute or two, we have learned that François Fillon has been sentenced to 2 years behind bars. Prosecutors had demanded a 5-year sentence, 3 years to be suspended and 2 behind bars. And it seems that the judges have delivered that sentence as requested.
What about, presumably they're going to sentence his wife and an aide too?
Yes, his wife has been sentenced to 3 years suspended. So she will not serve any prison time, but François Fillon will have to spend 2 years behind bars. This is absolutely momentous in France because this is one of a number of fraud cases against senior politicians, and it's seen by some as a test of whether the French elite can be held accountable. And so this is huge. Never before in France's post-war history has a former prime minister been sentenced to a prison term.
It also emerged, didn't it? It wasn't just his wife involved. His children were involved too, his grown-up children.
His grown-up children were allegedly involved in much the same circumstances as his wife, but prosecutors decided that they were not to blame for that, that money may have been paid to their accounts without them fully understanding the circumstances. And so it was only François Fillon and his wife who stood trial, not their children, although one of Mr. Fillon's aides also went on trial and was also found guilty.
You say it's momentous. Is this a sea change for France?
Well, I think it is a sea change. 9 years ago, the former president Jacques Chirac received a suspended prison sentence for corruption. And many French journalists and political pundits I spoke to in the last few weeks assumed that that's what would happen in the case of François Fillon. But it hasn't. He's going to have to do 2 years behind bars. And so this is being seen as a huge moment and possibly a turning point in French politics.
David Chazan speaking to me from Paris. The lawyer for François and Penelope Fillon say they'll appeal against the verdict. As we recorded this podcast, the security forces in Pakistan's largest city, Karachi, said they'd killed four gunmen who'd attacked the country's stock exchange. The assailants tried to storm the building, and it's understood that several other people also died in the attack. The gunmen launched grenades at the main gate of the stock exchange compound before opening fire, but police say they failed to gain entry. The vice president of the stock exchange, Amit Chinoy, described what happened.
At about 10:10 a.m. in the morning, four terrorists tried to enter the building. They were intercepted at the front gate. They came in a car, which is supposedly a Toyota car, and they were fully armed, equipped with machine guns and other type of weapons also.
The building was evacuated of other staff, and local authorities say they've secured all the evidence and are examining the car. Our Pakistan correspondent Sikandar Kamani told me more about the attack.
It's unclear quite how far into the compound they managed to get. We have had reports of some injuries from inside the stock exchange building, but certainly the three casualties that we know about so far are of two security guards and one policeman who were outside the compound or outside the main building and were engaging in a firefight with these gunmen. Now, the group that's responsible, it's called the Balochistan Liberation Army. They and other militants from the western province of Balochistan have been waging a low-level insurgency for decades. They want independence from the rest of Pakistan. The province is the poorest, least developed part of the country, but has a number of valuable natural resources. Most of their attacks generally are within the province of Balochistan, targeting the security forces, but they have also at times targeted Karachi. For example, in 2018, they claimed responsibility for an attack on the Chinese consulate in the city. That's because China's been heavily investing in infrastructure projects in Balochistan that the militants are opposed to.
Do we know why they launched this attack in Karachi?
Karachi is the commercial capital of Pakistan, and clearly launching an attack on the stock exchange, their intent, one imagines, would have been to cause economic disruption and gather international attention to the attack. Reports from security officials on the ground say that they found food items amongst the belongings of the militants, suggesting perhaps that they were looking to try and carry out some kind of hostage situation, maybe hold themselves up in the stock exchange for a period of time. They were obviously not able to do that because of the actions by the security forces.
Sikandar Kamani. God's little soldier. That's how the self-styled Islamic State group has described the coronavirus. In Iraq and Syria, the outbreak has meant fewer Western troops to meet its threat. In both countries, IS has re-emerged with a guerrilla campaign of assassinations and execution-style killings. IS has again pledged to free its women and children who are being held in their thousands in Kurdish-controlled detention camps. And those camps are no longer secure, according to our Middle East correspondent, Quentin Somerville.
A year and a half since their capture, and the camps holding the women of the Islamic State group have grown thick with extremism. In mobile phone footage from the Al-Hol camp, they march defiantly through the tents, IS flags aloft. God is great, they chant. At the hems of their black abaya dresses, their children follow. IS shall remain, they proclaim in small voices. The women's belief that they will be reunited with their extremist husbands is a firm article of faith. Many long for the return of their vicious caliphate. But some women who live in the camps claim a change of heart, and they say they now live in fear. Kimberly Pullman is a Canadian detainee.
When you keep people, if there's a few that are extreme, they will infect the others in the camp because people are weak. We've seen tents burn down. A tent burns in 58 seconds. That's real. And every woman here cooks. They have knives. That we've seen them die.
Some countries have repatriated children and some women from the camps, but most remain.
Women like myself, the friends I have, our lives are in danger every day here. And that's because we speak out now. And when you speak against a group like ISIS, if there's one thing that I think we all learned is that they will kill. They're not kidding. They don't lie.
In the eastern city of Hasaka, not far from the camps, heavily armed Kurdish forces, clad in balaclavas and body armour, are on the hunt. They kick in the steel gate to a house. Inside, two Russian women, and one from Uzbekistan, with their children. They're escapees from the Al-Hol camp. At gunpoint, they are arrested and lined up, facing a wall, the children too. They were bound for Turkey, according to local officials, and have now been returned to the camps. One escape route appears to be through Idlib, the Islamist rebel-held province to the west on the border with Turkey. There, a people smuggler describes his trade.
In Al Hol camp, the first step is coordination between smugglers and families inside. The smuggler charges about $1,700 to $3,000 per head. There are two ways, either through the main gate or over the wire. They are then transported to safe houses in Raqqa or Hasaka provinces.
In the streets of Syria's Deir ez-Zor, once an IS stronghold, locals again live in fear. IS is back. On a wall, graffiti announces, "The Caliphate remains." The people here need no reminder. An IS propaganda video celebrates its latest round of grim murders and assassinations. In Iraq and Syria, there are now fewer Western troops. The coronavirus and troop withdrawals have diminished their numbers. It's mainly local forces, with the help of Western air power, including the Royal Air Force, that do the fighting. A night operation of Kurdish-led special forces targets a house. The soldiers crawl across the building, entering by the roof. A front door lock is picked. In this raid, they round up 150 suspected IS members. Hundreds more are still at large. IS once commanded cities and armies. The group is diminished, but it is again re-emerging from the shadows. Its reach to the west is curtailed, but in Syria and in Iraq it is re-establishing its hold. With the world distracted, the Islamic State group has not rested.
That report from Quentin Somerville, our Middle East correspondent. And staying on the subject of Syria, the head of the UN's World Food Programme has warned that unless more aid money is made available, that nation faces the risk of mass starvation. David Beasley told the BBC that nearly half of all Syrians go to bed hungry, as Lise Doucette reports.
Syria, ravaged by nearly a decade of war, is now reeling from another severe crisis. Its currency has collapsed and food prices are soaring. David Beasley appealed to the West to overcome its fatigue with the long-running war. He said world powers must allow aid to reach Syrians in the last rebel-held areas, as well as those controlled by the government. Mr. Beasley's message to donors meeting this week is that desperate Syrians may have no choice but to try to flee again, as they did in the mass exodus towards Europe in 2015.
Lise Doucette. Damning allegations about the deliberate killing by security services of children in the Philippines have emerged in a newly published report by the World Organization Against Torture, an international coalition of organizations tackling violence. The organization, based in Switzerland, has documented the deaths of at least 122 children between the ages of 1 and 17 in the Philippines between 2016 and 2019. I asked our correspondent in Geneva, Imogen Folks, for more details.
What they say is, you know, that they have examined reports from the authorities, they've talked to witnesses, they've talked to families, that these are children who have been killed primarily by the police and by services affiliated to the police. Sometimes because they were witness to other violence committed by the security services, sometimes in retaliation for things their families were suspected of doing. Sometimes because they were just in the way.
Can you give us any specific example?
Well, there is one of a seven-year-old boy who was shot in cold blood, apparently because he had witnessed something, and so he had to be taken out of the way. There's also the case of a little girl just 20 months old who was killed. And what the report says is that despite the fact that there has been more attention on this kind of violence being perpetrated by the security services in the Philippines, the killings continue, with at least seven children killed in the first 3 months of this year.
These are absolutely damning allegations. Has the government in the Philippines responded?
This particular report is just out today in the last couple of hours. However, there was also a report, a more general report, on the tactics used in the Philippines government's so-called war on drugs, from UN human rights experts, where they actually called for sanctions on the Philippines government. This has already been rejected by the Philippines government. They say that they are prosecuting rogue police officers and that there's no need for anything like sanctions. That human rights report, however, will be discussed at the UN Human Rights Council. Its session starts tomorrow here in Geneva. I think there's growing pressure now on member states to approve the most serious form of investigation into the Philippines, a UN-approved independent inquiry, the likes of which we've seen, for example, for Syria, for Myanmar, because the mounting evidence and the fact that children are also, it seems, being killed with impunity is not something the UN Human Rights Council can really afford to overlook.
Imogen Folks in Geneva. Still to come in this edition of our podcast.
Highly respected people in Ghana have taken their infected children out of the hospital. They drank the medicine and recovered.
How false claims about COVID-19 are making people ditch modern medicine and buy expensive fake cures. So far, a cure hasn't been found for COVID-19, but every day doctors are discovering more about how it affects the body. Now it's been recommended that patients who become critically ill with the disease should be screened for post-traumatic stress disorder and have access to specialist mental health support. Our medical correspondent Fergus Walsh told me more about the latest research findings.
This working group of a number of UK universities, University College London, Oxford University, King's College London, have put an estimate, just a baseline estimate, of 30% of intensive care patients who survive COVID-19 will suffer post-traumatic stress disorder, and a further 15% will suffer anxiety disorders and 15% depression. But that is based on previous outbreaks and other experiences in intensive care, and there may be further factors that make COVID-19 worse.
Well, I mean, it's a frightening number of people who are affected then. What are scientists recommending?
So that what they want to ensure is that people who have survived that experience get followed up and they get access to mental health services. There is a real concern about things that are peculiar to COVID-19 because, for a start, people have been in intensive care. They don't have their families around them, which would normally be the case. When they do wake up, they see staff in full personal protective equipment, which can be, you know, very destabilizing and disturbing. So they want to ensure people are monitored because otherwise they fear there will be a sort of subsequent epidemic of mental health problems. And these could affect not just people who've gone through intensive care, but also people who never, thankfully, quite made it to a ventilator, but were just seriously ill. Obviously, it's primarily a respiratory disease affecting the lungs. But because of that lack of oxygen, primarily at the start, it's a viral attack on the body. But then after about 7 days, most people manage to fend off that viral attack. But in the others, it's not the virus that causes the damage from that point. It's the overreaction of the immune system, this massive overreaction, this what they call a cytokine storm, causes inflammation throughout the body, and that can be inflammation in the tissues, it can be inflammation in the brain. We're seeing strokes, we're seeing a massive problem with kidney failure, and really there's almost no organ of the body that's untouched. And the mental health aspect of it is just one of many that we're seeing in patients all over the world.
Fergus Walsh. With more than 500,000 people around the world dying as a result of the coronavirus pandemic, the fear and uncertainty has created a perfect opportunity to push fake cures. According to the World Health Organization, there's currently no vaccine or cure for COVID-19, but that hasn't stopped many people from claiming to have found one. BBC Africa Eye and Ghanaian investigative journalist Anas Aremeya Anas have been investigating the sale of fake coronavirus cures in Ghana and what the authorities are doing to stop it.
In Ghana, I've been investigating two scammers, quack doctors known as the Abdallah Brothers. They surfaced during the country's lockdown, claiming they had invented a cure for coronavirus. The younger brother, who calls himself Dr. Abdallah Jr., appeared on a popular local radio talk show to publicize their mystery herbal concoction.
How sure are you, sir, when you are a cure COVID-19?
Well, my confidence level is 99.9.
To avoid being prosecuted by authorities, He claimed they were not selling the drug, but they were only providing it to the Ghana Food and Drug Authority, known as the FDA. But he happily gave out his phone number on the radio.
My number is 0547.
I arranged to meet the brothers at their clinic just outside Accra. The walls of the front room were lined, floor to ceiling, with bottles containing their so-called cure, as well as microscopes and test tubes. Due to the poor sound quality, we have used actors' voices. Dr. Abdallah Jr. did his best to persuade me their drug could cure coronavirus.
This medicine doesn't need trials because we know the potency of our medicine.
Each bottle had COVID cure written on it in big letters and stated it offered an effective treatment within 2 weeks. It also had a fake FDA number on the label. Dr. Abdallah Sr. claimed people were leaving quarantine in hospitals to seek out their drug.
Highly respected popular people in Ghana have taken their infected children out of the hospital. They drank the medicine and recovered.
They initially demanded over $600 for 3 bottles of their so-called cure, but we paid them less than $200 and left. After our meeting, they called me repeatedly in the hope that I will purchase more. I returned to meet them in a modern house on the edge of Accra. What I found inside shocked me. In an unfurnished room were more than 100 bottles of fake cure laid out on the floor. Again, I secretly recorded our meeting. Dr. Abdallah Sr. was keen to boast about the potency of the product.
Out of all the medicines that I make, this is the strongest.
They demanded over $25,000 for 100 bottles. We agreed. They thought they had hit the jackpot, but we would never come back and pay for the drugs.
And what brings you here this time?
It's various concoctions that we have collected, and we are here to test it.
We had the Abdallah Brothers bottles tested at the Ghana Standard Authority. This is where prospective medicines are tested before going to the market. They were found to be contaminated with bacteria and mold and were not fit for human consumption. We put our findings to the director of the Ghana Food and Drugs Authority, Delasi Mimidakun.
Just by looking at the product, I can tell you it's not registered. FDA would never allow you to put this in your product, COVID cure.
Less than 24 hours after our interview, the FDA raided the brothers' production facility and found almost 300 bottles of so-called COVID cures. Dr. Abdallah Jr. repeatedly tried to persuade the agents he was not selling these concoctions.
Well, we have not sold this thing in any way.
The brothers told us their product was for testing purposes only and that they are taking steps to license it. Following our investigation, the Abdallah brothers have been detained for questioning by the FDA.
The Ghanaian journalist Anas Arameo Anas, and that investigation was carried out in conjunction with BBC Africa Eye. Now to the US, where the state senate in Mississippi has passed a resolution to remove the Confederate emblem from its state flag. Mississippi is the last state in the US to include the Confederate battle flag, which is viewed by some as a racist symbol, on its state flag. And the authorities there have come under intense pressure after the nationwide protests over the death of George Floyd. Kelly Skinner is the deputy managing editor of Mississippi Today, an online newspaper. She's been following events there, and she told Lawrence Pollard about the background to this decision.
Well, this flag has been here since 1894, so it's 126 years now, and it did actually go to a vote in 2001, and voters decided to keep it. But I think a big difference this time around is that a lot of big businesses. I mean, in the States for us, Walmart, the entity that oversees college sports, which are a big deal here, the NCAA, said that we can't have any championship games of any kind until they get rid of that flag. And of course, constituents are reaching out to their lawmakers by the thousands, telling them that they want this to be taken down now.
Now, that's very interesting. And you're saying that that's a difference from kind of 2001. So economic fears begin to play in. And these, of course, are economic fears expressed at a wider level, all because of poor George Floyd, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I think actually what kicked this off was we had a Black Lives Matter protest in Jackson a few weeks ago, where one of the protesters' demands as they were protesting for George Floyd was that the state get rid of this flag. And in the week after, that conversation started happening about how do we actually do this. And of course, as you just mentioned, we started seeing some actual repercussions from industry, from just virtually every kind of area of the state you could think of. People were coming out publicly and saying, do this. It's a bad look for Mississippi. We're the last to have this emblem on our flag. And we're also the blackest state in the country. So it's, for a lot of people, something that's very hurtful and racist. And today they made that decision to take that flag down.
Now, what happens when you redesign a flag? Have other states done something similar?
Other states have taken this flag down. South Carolina was the last one to do this, I think, in 2015. But in Mississippi, what that's going to look like is there's going to be a commission with 9 members on it, and it's their responsibility to produce a new design for this flag by September. And then, of course, in November 3rd, around the same time as our presidential election, voters are going to either decide that they want that or not. And so all it needs is a majority to become the new state flag. And should it not, then they just have to create a new design. And we're essentially not going to have a state flag until the voters pick a new one.
Kayleigh Skinner, Deputy Managing Editor of the online newspaper Mississippi Today, speaking there to Lawrence Pollard. And finally, a story from New Zealand, but it's not New Zealand as you might expect it. Amidst the North Island's rugged hills lies a town which looks as if it's been transplanted from another country and another century. Our reporter Gareth Barlow told me more.
It's a place called Mellon's Folly Ranch. It was built in 2006. And like you say, not like New Zealand at all. That's because it's a replica of an American Wild West town. It looks like Wyoming from the 1860s. Let's listen to an excerpt of the town's promo video. That gives you a sense of the place.
Stroll the boardwalk back to the 1890s. Stay in Western opulence in Miss Nancy Ann's Hotel. Walk through the swing doors into the Lucky Strike Saloon. Strike it rich in the gold mine. Stage a hold-up in the bank and then stand trial in the Waterfall Mountain Courthouse.
And as you hear there, the saloon, the courthouse down the main street, there's 10 buildings, including accommodation for 22 people. And it is beautiful. There's these rolling tree-clad hills that then descend down to the pastel-painted wooden buildings beneath them. All of that is for sale, including a business as well, because it's New Zealand, that makes Manuka honey from bees, for the, well, humble price of $7.5 million.
You should be an estate agent.
I do have a side hustle. I would hasten to say I'm not getting commission for this sale, unfortunately. But if you buy the town, you can then have it to rent and run it as a business. And that's what currently is. It's a private town. So people pay per night to come and use it for away days and business ventures, for example.
And why should it appeal to people so much? Because you say there's been a lot of interest.
There's a potential loophole that's very useful for international buyers. Currently in New Zealand, only people from Australia and Singapore can buy pre-existing houses to go and live. That was a rule introduced by the New Zealand government to prevent house prices booming and inflating too much. However, because this is a business venture, you can go and invest into it, get an investor's visa, and then claim residency as a result of that. And so people from America and from Hong Kong have proven to be particularly interested in this. Some people are suggesting maybe even coronavirus-related, New Zealand's done fairly well with regards to COVID-19. But certainly people are looking for a new home, but it seems an old way of life.
Gareth Barlow honing his house hunting skills there. And before we go, Jackie Leonard has a favour to ask.
I do have a favour to ask you. The Global News podcast has been nominated for a thing. And I know it's a little vulgar to ask, and as a British person, this really is toe-curlingly embarrassing. But if you could take a minute to support us, we would really be thrilled to bits to win. And it's only fair to say that the competition we're up against is actually quite good, so your vote does count. It's the Listener's Award at the British Podcast Awards. The web address is britishpodcastawards.com/vote, and you are looking for the Global News Podcast, obviously, if you've done it already. Thank you.
And thank you, Jackie, and thank you to everyone from all of us. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or any of the topics we've covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
I was skeptical about ordering foundation online. I can't even find a match in stores. Then I discovered Il Makiage. Their online quiz found my exact shade in seconds. With Try Before You Buy, you can try your full-size shade at home free for 14 days. But I was obsessed on day one. It's so lightweight and natural, it's literally my skin in a bottle. Take the quiz at ilmakiage.com/quiz. That's ilmakiage.com/quiz.